Crime covers a lot of ground, as do rates of various categories of crime. Well, Mike, today let's talk about gun violence and homicide rates that have risen in recent years, including here in Portland, starting with the three scenes of fatal shootings in Portland over the weekend of February 19th and 20th, and particularly the mass shooting at a racial justice protest event in Northeast Portland. Before we turn to the coverage of this tragedy through the media and police reports, what happened that, and why were the protesters gathered? I think a part of the story that often gets lost in the incident and the conflicting accounts of the shootings themselves.
Well, Jen, the reason why people were gathered was because of the murder of Amir Locke in Minneapolis. And it was an atrocious event because it was a systemic murder. It wasn't like a rogue devil cop. It was murder executed and orchestrated by the entire Minneapolis criminal justice system, who gave a no-knock search warrant to the cops on the flimsiest of reasons. So the cops are entering the house of Amir Locke at 7 a.m., They obtained a key of their own, so they're unlocking his house, and they come in and they're shouting. So Locke is asleep on the couch. He has a weapon of his own because of the proliferation of guns, I imagine. But anyway, he is duly licensed and was there to protect himself, but he didn't have a chance. There were three or four cops immediately around him, and as soon as he reaches and touches his gun, they fire many shots and kill him. So people were gathered in the park to protest this murder of a young Black man, which was, as I said, the outcome of a system, not of a particularly deranged individual.
The Minneapolis police have not been particularly chastened by the murder of George Floyd and the uprisings around the country and the world, basically, in response to that. And so the ongoing demonstrations and remembrance of Black people being killed by the police was part of what happened here in Northeast Portland. Let's talk about the media coverage of the most media intensive of the shootings that weekend, because of course it did focus on police violence and resistance to police violence, and unfolded in a way that began with the police having their own press conference on Sunday morning, the police chief. What was striking to you about the media coverage of the shootings as they unfolded?
Well, at first, how little of it there was. I mean, it was agonizingly slow for the details to be revealed. The police press conference gave almost no details and was profoundly misleading. What we now know happened is that a gunman, Benjamin Smith, killed a 60-year-old woman and wounded three other women and another man who were a volunteer security guard for the protest, who were directing traffic, not even close to the actual demonstration itself. He started shooting them and was only stopped by a security guard who's heard what was happening, hurried over and shot the gunman Smith in his hip.
A security guard with the demonstration itself.
Yes. So the next morning we found out almost none of this. Instead, we had a statement that from the cops attributing the violence to the confrontation between an armed homeowner and armed protesters.
That was the focus of considerable outrage on social media. What's implicit in using the term homeowner in describing the gunman?
Well, your home is your castle. It's a fundamental principle of American law. Anybody who's fighting to defend themselves in their own home, you're allowed to shoot anybody who might even be threatening to come into your house. It's a whole other concept than somebody who's out on the street roaming around carrying a weapon. It's a fundamental distortion of the facts.
As was the framing of the violence as a confrontation between armed protesters and an armed homeowner.
That's right. The traffic guards were strikingly nonviolent. They always had been. The woman who died had been made herself available to do just that sort of work at demonstrations. It was completely nonviolent. They were directing traffic.
You know, it struck me that if this had been a mass shooting at a school or a mall, that the security person licensed to carry an arm who shot and disabled the gunman would have been declared a hero. But in this case, there was just a question of whether charges would be filed, and no charges were filed because it was clearly a defensive act. Why wasn't this security person declared a hero?
Well, I think he was a hero. I think it's a paradox in that it's very clear that the only kind of crime that has really been increasing over the last 2 years is gun violence. Robberies, rapes, property crimes, they've all either remained level or mostly gone down. But easy access to guns has meant that disputes of all sorts, which are part of living in a human society, now get resolved with weapons. And so the number of people shot has gone up, even though the total remains about a third, about a third of what it was in the 90s. But still, directionality is important. And even though the overall totals are far less than they were a couple decades ago, they are getting worse. They are increasing.
Well, what lessons might we draw from this tragedy? There's both the outrage over the police and the mayor's reporting and framing of it. But I think what was also important was organized activists challenging those accounts and pushing the Oregonian to properly cover the shootings and pushing back on the police narrative. So that seems to be one of the important lessons.
You know, social media has been deservedly getting a bad rap lately. The fact that Facebook thrives on confrontation and aggression and creates it in order to increase engagement. There's all kinds of things damning social media that have emerged. But here we should be grateful because it was the various tweets and communications on social media that made the truth come out. The Oregonian found these people as a result of social media. Finally, a couple of days later, had a good story about what happened. The one point I'd like to make is, it doesn't seem to be an immediate link, but actually it is. And that is the $73 million settlement that was made just 5 days ago, when gun manufacturers, or rather their insurance companies, for the Sandy Hook incident, had to pay out $73 million. And the reason they were forced to do it was because the plaintiffs found an ingenious way around the federal law that insulates gun manufacturers from any damages for anything anybody ever does with their weapons. What these clever plaintiffs found was a Connecticut law, state law, about consumer advertising. And they, through discovery, found that Remington was issuing ads about AR-15s, which are semi-automatic weapons that can be converted to automatic weapons. Exactly the weapon that was used by the young man who killed all those kids in Connecticut. And what they came up with was an ad, a picture of a AR-15 in some great detail. And the caption is, "Consider your man card reissued, Bushmaster."
Well, I think this is very relevant to the situation of Benjamin Smith, who has been universally declared a right winger, white supremacist, was clearly, you know, misogynist, had become, according to his roommate, more and more angry, obsessed with guns, angry about houseless people, the Black Lives Matter movement and protests. And there was something fueling his fire as an apparently fairly isolated, wasn't associated with organized far right groups, but there was something fueling his fire and directing his anger and his increasing preoccupation with weapons.
And discovery of Remington's internal documents show that he is precisely the kind of person they're as aimed at. The quote, so-called couch commandos, people who live in a fantasy world of their own, who are not engaged in any great detail with either their work or with any other social movement or with their family.
By the way, are more apt to be younger white men.
Yep, exactly. So there are targeted ads aimed at exactly the category of person he is, which are effective. Of course, guns have proliferated so much that now the people buying them are the secondary level of people who aren't so fond of guns, who don't believe that their masculinity hinges on buying a gun, but who are afraid of all the people around who have guns.
So, yeah, even at, including at protest events.
Exactly.
So getting back to the reason for the demonstration that you began with and the protesters gathering to in remembrance of Emir Locke and protesting ongoing police killings, how should those of us who call for decarceration, abolishing of policing, how do we assess the victories through the courts in prosecuting white supremacists and police who killed Black people? I know Mike Schmidt here, and in this case, the DA is putting forth relatively serious, not surprisingly, charges against Benjamin Smith. But how do you think about the call for more serious, aggressive prosecution of police and racists versus our larger call for the abolition of policing and alternative means of addressing problems outside the criminal justice system?
Well, I think what needs to happen is an equal enforcement. That is, Schmidt's charges are totally appropriate. The disposition of the defendants who were found guilty is another question. But I think in the South, the great thing, and the irony to me is the South, source of segregationists, and is moving in the right direction in that they're now trying and convicting people for the same crimes that they would have certainly charged Black people with. So there's they're moving toward equivalence. Whereas in
which is a form of progress.
It's very much a form of progress. In fact, it's the fundamental form of progress, I think. Equal treatment under the laws. That's precisely what Black people have never had in any systematic way. And it's something we should always move toward. Now, what we're going to do with people after we convict them is a completely separate question in my mind. But there needs to be absolute equal enforcement of the laws. The most discouraging thing to me about the killing of Emir Locke is that the liberal mayor, Jacob Frey, had promised before not to do no-knock warrants. And there's all kinds of efforts to train, retrain, and re-retrain the police. There are vows made, but they just all fade away. And this whole no-knock warrant and the flimsy reasons given for it could have happened 5 years ago. So it means that reform is much more than just a statement or a press release mollifying people who are pressing you. It's a difficult thing. It should be a sustained thing. And it definitely needs to happen in Minneapolis.
So in closing, it's important to honor racial justice activist June Knightley, a beloved member of the community who'd been part of protests for years, and the LGBTQ community, and also the reason for their meeting that night, a demonstration that was called short as June Knightley gave her life unwillingly to the in remembrance of Amir Locke, the Black man who was killed by Minneapolis police. So this struggle continues. Thanks, Mike. On a upcoming show, we'll also talk about the gains on the front of progressive prosecutors around the country.
There are lots of them, and they are now organized.
More to discuss in the future in the left and the law.